Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello everyone, I'm Sibylla Zee, the host of New Books in Historical Fiction, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Today I'm speaking with Charles Todd about A Cruel Deception, the latest of their many novels set during and not long after World War I. This book is the 10th in a series featuring Sister Bess Crawford, a British nurse, but you'll also hear us talking about a second series centered on Detective Ian Rutledge, which I also love. But this novel is about Bess, so let's start with her. England, late March, 1919. I was changing the surgical dressing on a patient in Ward 3 when Matron sent for me. For some weeks now, I'd been posted to a clinic in Wiltshire for surgical cases like this abdomen. A piece of shrapnel missed in earlier surgeries had worked its way into the colon and caused a massive infection. Sergeant Higgins had been recovering well when this happened, but Dr. Johnson had done a marvelous piece of surgery to locate a source of the infection. It had almost been too late. Another few hours and the infection would have spread to the abdominal lining. I finished what I was doing, smiled at the drowsy sergeant, and handed my patient over to Sister Newman. That should do for now, I said, and went to wash my hands before going down to Matron's tiny ground floor office. She was writing a letter when I knocked, and I stood quietly by the door until she'd finished it. When she did look up, she frowned, and I felt suddenly like a schoolgirl who'd been caught in some mischief. As far as I knew, I'd done nothing wrong, but her frown had the power to make a saint feel guilty. It was one of her best weapons against carelessness and stupid mistakes. "You've had a remarkable career until now, Sister Crawford," she began. "Have you given any thought to the future?" "Oh, dear." And now, please join me in welcoming Charles Todd. Hi, Charles and Caroline. I look forward to talking with you today.
Oh, hello. We're very happy to be here.
You make no secret of being a mother-son team. Obviously, you're very successful, which impresses me, because much as I love my son, I can't imagine writing a novel with him. So what made you decide to write as a pair? And having decided, how do you tackle a new book?
Well, we have always been mystery fans, I mean, even from the books being read to us as children. And we are both history buffs. So one day we wondered if we could actually write a mystery. And of course, since history is, you know, our favorite period, it was natural to choose the past as our time frame. It seemed to work well with both the mystery and the idea of neophyte writers.
Well, we wanted it to be an accessible past, one closer to our time and pertinent to our time. We didn't want to go back where it was Middle English and bespoke, et cetera. So no one was writing about the Great War, and it was a period with ramifications for the future. So we decided to give it a try. And as it turned out, we found it was a time that resonated with us, which was a good thing, some 30 books later.
As for how we write together, tackling a book, we learned early on that what one of us knew, the other one had to know, whether it's about characters or some aspect of the period or working through an action scene. So what we discovered was that we were likely to get off on a tangent that the other person couldn't follow. And this presented problems. I mean, there was no collaboration for dummies available, and we were trying to find our way.
That decided we talked over every aspect of the writing before word goes on paper, and then we work out every scene together, putting down what we feel is the best approach. Sometimes one of us will test an idea, and if it works, we go with it. And if it doesn't, we move on. It's actually, I think of books as a movie in the mind and trying to capture what each of us sees.
That's very interesting. So in addition to the series, which we're going to get to in just a minute, you have two standalone novels as well, The Murder Stone and The Walnut Tree. Where do they stand within the corpus of your writing? Are they also World War One?
Yes. We had written a few Rutledges, and through our research, we decided that we wanted to take a closer look at what women were doing during the war, what happened to these women who were left behind once their men walked off to war. And that led us to Francesca, the character in the standalone. She suddenly finds herself not only inheriting her grandfather's estate, but also inheriting his enemies. And it was very interesting to see this period through the eyes of a woman. She finds herself in love with two men on different sides of the channel, and she can't save one of them. It was a novella, and it was fun to write, but it showed what was to come when the war that was expected to end by Christmas dragged on for four long bloody years, and what women were subjected to without any warning, any preparation.
Really, that really encompasses both books, The Walnut Tree and The Murder Stone. But it was an excellent opportunity for us not only to look at it from a women's point of view, but it was a society in the midst of change. The roles of women had been very strictly defined during the Victorian period, and yet during World War One, so many women were thrust into situations like Francesca, and that had to cope with unexpected situations that they were completely unprepared for. And also in terms of their avocation, women were driving trucks, they were doing all kinds of working in factories, things that any time before then would have been totally outside socially acceptable behavior for women. And it brought about a great deal of change in English society.
And that was The Walnut Tree.
I see. Yes, I think people have started to rediscover World War One because of the centennial. But certainly when you started these books, nobody wrote about World War One. It was all World War Two.
Yes, that's right.
I really like to read it. Mm-hmm.
They didn't write about World War One, and they didn't write much about PTSD because that was long before 9/11. And the whole concept of shell shock and how it was perceived by society through time was not something that people talked about a great deal. It kind of took us by surprise when they got the attention that it did.
Absolutely.
Which segues beautifully into Ian Rutledge. I'm going to ask about him before we get to Bess, because he's where I first discovered you. And I was, you know, if you're a reader, the best thing is to find a series that already has a whole bunch of books. I just haven't had time to go back and read them all, but I promise I will. So the first one I found was The Black Ascot. And I've actually, now I have the advanced review copy of the next one, A Divided Loyalty, on my desk, which I'm looking forward to. So tell us a little bit about Ian, who definitely does suffer from shell shock, among other things.
Well, there were several things we were looking for. We wanted a man, basically, who had seen both sides of killing, murder, and the war. And we were interested in what this might do to him as a person. And it was important to explore this as a man from book to book to book. Shell shock, as you mentioned, was one of the nasty little secrets of the Great War, and we wanted to talk about that. So that's when Ian Rutledge was born. He himself came up with a shell shock because he couldn't go back to the yard if he had come out of the trenches terribly wounded. So here he is in 1914, a new inspector at Scotland Yard. He has a very promising career, and he's engaged to marry. And like many men of his age, he still decides to go and to join the army. He's sent to the trenches, and they nearly destroy him. And coping with that has in a way become both his torment and his strength.
And he's English, a man of honor with a strong code of ethics of his generation. He's a university man, but he wants to be a policeman and really defies his family to join the Met. But the Yard is only just bringing in educated men, and it brings about a conflict between the old guard who came up through the ranks and these college-educated newcomers that seem to be skipping steps that they had fought so hard to climb. And it makes for a difficult time, and Rutledge, who sometimes sees more deeply into a case, has to fight for what he believes to be the truth. And it's a challenge to write, but it's one we enjoy.
And you do it very well. Yes, it's hard to remember that being a policeman, especially a detective, was not always a high-status thing, especially in England.
That's right. And as the old guard, who were mainly blue-collar, found themselves replaced by men who could move in society with greater ease, then it was hard to accept. You know, I've done all of this, and here you come with a university degree, and you think you can do better. Show me.
Oh, a very natural response. So tell us about Bess. Who is Bess at the moment that we meet her in A Cruel Deception?
Well, she's also English. She grew up wherever her father was posted because he was a career military officer. And much of her youth was spent in India. It's never, at that time, was never a really safe posting. And so she learns early on how the army works, how to protect herself from danger, what duty and responsibility and the honor of the regiment mean. It was a very different upbringing, and it was part of what prepared her to be able to be a word we hate, a sleuth, but someone who gets involved in things that a Victorian young woman might never come across.
So when the Great War begins, she can't fight as a son might, but she is driven by this sense of honor and duty to join a military service and save lives in the course of her duties. And there are often matters where she's called upon to deal with situations beyond her nursing skills. And she, because of this upbringing and her background, she has both the courage and the grasp of the situation to find the answers. And this gave us a chance to see the war from both a woman's point of view and some of the interesting sidelights, like an aid station winding up in German hands, or realizing that the influenza, among the influenza dead, there's a body that didn't die of the flu.
And in this particular case, the war has officially ended. And Bess is still nursing. But she can envision the possibility of change, and she's not completely sure that she likes it.
Well, Francesca and the Murder Stone was really a one-book story. It didn't lend itself to a series, but it intrigued us because it showed us the role that women took on in the war, and we wanted to go into that further with a character who was deeply involved both in the war itself and in the home front. Beth was well suited to this. I mean, she's the kind of woman we find it a pleasure to write. And she has a sense of humor, that sense of duty, and then from her nursing, a very clear objective view of what she's getting into and then has to get out of.
Yes, she's a very likable character. I mean, I really enjoyed her. What made you decide tell this particular story?
Well, I was going to say Bess is young, but she puts her personal life aside to go into nursing. And it's only one of the jobs women took at the time, but this is a mystery series, of course. And so her class, in quotes, have to do with the war. A severe explosion in a munitions plant, a sinking of the Britannic, whatever. They add realistic aspects of her life and her work that's, we hope, intriguing for the reader at the same time.
Well, I certainly found this situation in A Cruel Deception interesting. You know, it's not a classic murder mystery. It's rather a genuine mystery in the sense that you don't know what's going on. And we're not going to talk about what's going on except in the most general ways because we want people to read it. But what is going on at the beginning of A Cruel Deception?
She's a very good nurse and she finds satisfaction in this. So when the war is over, she wants to keep on working with the wounded who will never go home. She sees that very clearly, that these are men who will, with time, being forgotten, and that there will be a need for nurses for a very long time to come.
And that dealing with gallbladders and kidney stones isn't really her future. And yet going home as her parents' daughter and fitting into that role again isn't what she wants either. She's taken responsibility for human lives, and she's not really ready to settle into a quote-unquote quiet life.
And does she see this kind of long-term nursing as a quiet life?
Well, the problem with this is that the Queen Alexandra's, like the other nursing services, started out with a small group of women, and when the war came, they expanded to about 8,000 nurses in the various campaigns. But with the war over, what are they going to do with all these nurses? And they will ask some to teach. Some will be dismissed to women who have resources, a family, money of their own, whatever. And some will be kept on. I think they went from 8,000 to about 300. So Beth realizes that this is going to come up in her career, and yet she wants to keep doing what she's doing.
I see. So it's the prospect of being laid off, in effect, that worries her most.
Well, exactly. Exactly. Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of the women, most of the women in the Queen Alexandra's were upper class young women, or certainly upper middle class. And these women may need a job in the future, but they are not as desperate as some of the others who need to make a career of this in order to survive.
So she is summoned to London, and her initial expectation is that, in effect, she's going to be invited to leave. But instead, she's sent to Paris. And what is she supposed to do in Paris?
Well, she's asked to find out what's wrong with the son of one of the heads of the Queen Alexandra. He's been assigned to the peace talks going on in Paris, but he's dropped out of sight. And although he's recovered from the shoulder wound that he received in the last days of the war, there's a possibility that the heavy painkillers he's been given have led to addiction. This happened more often than is recorded. But this would end his career in the army. And Bess is trained. She's a nurse. She's discreet. And Matron has known her parents, which is a recommendation in itself to assign her to a quiet mission.
She is sent to stay with a Dr. Moreau and his wife. Could you give us a brief sketch of them and how they fit into the story?
Well, the doctor and his wife have known Matron Helena Minton for many years. They will help her son if he's an addict without reporting him to his regiment, because this could be a career ender for him. But they've also lost their only son in the war, and their understanding of and compassion for Lawrence himself is in a way a part of their healing process. Bess is expected to stay with them as the base of where she will work from in Paris, but circumstances have a way of unexpectedly changing things, don't they?
Especially in a mystery story, yes.
Absolutely.
Or a novel at all, actually. If you don't shake things up, what's going to change?
Absolutely.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So you have one very relevant present day concern, which is the addiction. But the other thing I was thinking about as Charles was talking is it's hard for modern day Americans to imagine how pervasive the effects of the war were, especially in France and Britain, where almost everybody had lost somebody. And you just mentioned, you know, that Dr. Moreau and his wife have lost their son, but almost all the characters have lost close, fiancés or brothers or husbands or fathers in the war.
Yeah, I remember specifically... we were in a small village in England, and we walked into the bell tower in front of the church, and we were looking up at the names that had been carved into the walls of the sides of the bell tower, and we're reading up, and we realize even though they're getting further away and it's getting darker, as you go up higher, you can still tell that the names keep on going up. And the other thing that we noticed in that was how many of them all had the same last name. And
yes,
it really brought home the fact that in such a brief period of time, all the men of military age and an entire family had been wiped out.
I mean, you think in terms of wars nowadays that are mostly fought at distances. But on the first day of the Somme offensive in 1916, July 1st, there were 20,000 casualties on the British side. And there were so many men wounded that the doctors had to go among them and decide, this man I can save, this man I must let go. And it must have been horrific. I mean, you see your best friend blown apart. You see someone whose leg is missing or whose head is missing. This is a traumatic situation. This is something that leaves scars. Most of the people at home didn't know how their loved ones died. The Army just said in their letters that he had died bravely.
And we forget that these regiments were made up of people from the same geographical area. So you might have the Wiltshire Yeomanry or the Cumbrian Infantry. These are all people from the same area. So as they're fighting together, they know each other. They have tasks together. So it's not like some guy you met at basic training and don't know very well.
And so in the long run, they become very close. I mean, war makes brothers, and I firmly believe that.
Which just makes it harder. And it affects Bess as well, because I was just reading another novel about the situation for women after the war, that there were no men in their age group. You know, they could, in an age when it was still considered important for women to marry and have children as their sort of primary thing to do, there was no one to marry.
No.
It was their social status. I mean, you became the spinster of the family, the one who looked after the sick parents or grandmother, the one who helped with the children when a woman was expecting again. The sort of thing that became governesses where they could, but even that work was disappearing. These women had nowhere to go. And you look at some of the genealogies of the period and how many women never married. And these are not only the women, but the unborn children who would have made the next generation.
And it's another reason why Bess wants to stay in nursing, because it's not like she can just go home and...
Well, she could, but I think Bess has changed with the war, just like everybody else. And it's hard to put the horse back into the barn after it's tasted the grass. I mean, women had been able to do things, to go out of the home, find themselves. Even working in munitions factories, they had a status. They had something to be proud of. And then they're told to go back and do the dishes and clean the house and take a place that's changed so much that it's hard for them to accept. And most of them had to do it. The same thing happened after World War II, for that matter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it did. We hear about it more in World War II, but yes, the big change was really World War I.
Absolutely.
Let's talk a little bit about Paris itself in 1919. What was the city like right after the war?
Well, Paris had been a target for the Germans in the 1870s, and she came very close to being captured in World War I. She survived through a rather tenacious will to survive. The people who stayed in Paris were determined to keep her free. They also had a sense of style and aplomb. Women in Paris during the war would still try to wear their satins and laces, but they would cut them in a military style to show their support for the war. And even in restaurants where the food was so gray you couldn't tell what the meat was, they still went out and dined out. they were trying to carry on in a way that London was not. London was rather dour, rather grim, and the effects of the war were more easily seen. But designers of women's dresses began designing uniforms for the new troops. They designed uniforms for the flyers. They helped with the camouflage. I mean, it's just a fascinating time to look back to. You can only use so much in a novel, but exploring it was just fascinating. Then the peace treaty comes along, and Paris is flooded with everybody. The French delegations want revenge. The British are trying to temper that and still get their own way. Wilson comes in for the Americans with his peace plan and new ideas for the treaty, and tensions are high because all of this is going on at a time that was supposed to show results. The peace treaty wasn't brought together as a document until June of that year.
But despite all of this, Bess soon heads out of the city. Tell us a bit about what she finds outside of Paris.
Well, Bess finds him in the home of a young woman whose family is indebted to Lawrence for saving their father's life. And Lawrence reeks of drugs, and his behavior is far from that of a young officer who had been set on a career in the army. In fact, he calls Bess a spy for his mother and tells her that oblivion is his goal and she can't stop him. It's very typical of that type of addiction of, I'm not hurting anybody else by hurting myself. Almost a self-centered perspective, but he's got his heart set on just blotting everything out and basically semi-suicidal.
And he's staying with a young woman, Marina Lasalle, who in fact owns the house. What's her story?
Marina is a teacher in a private school for girls. And she's taken leave to get Lawrence out of Paris before his regiment sees what's happened to him. Unfortunately, there's little money, and she had to let the staff go. It's a struggle to provide coal, much less food, and she's pretty much at her wit's end when Beth arrives, but because of the family's strong feeling of indebtedness to Lawrence, it forces her to make excuses for him and try to take care of him, even though the struggle is nearly beyond her. And yet, she feels guilty when Bess begins to take charge, but even Bess is challenged by the situation.
Yes, there's nowhere she can turn for help. If she goes to her father, who's in the army, a report will get back to his regiment. If she goes to his mother in London, what can her mother do? His mother do that she can't do on the scene. It really throws her back on her own resources as a person and her ability to see a situation and work her way through it. First of all, why is he addicted? Secondly, what is it he's trying to hide from in his own life.
And she's quite firm with him. She doesn't put up with all of his nonsense at all.
Well, that's what the nurses did in the hospitals. They had to be very strict with these men. And nurses in the Queen Alexandra's had military rank to give their orders more clout. I mean, this was a protection for them. But Bess falls back on this strictness that quite often in the hospital got results.
So I don't think we can go too much farther into the book before we start to give away things that you probably don't want to give away. But I did want to mention that one of the things I really like, both about the Black Ascot and this one, is that the secondary characters are also fully worked out. A couple of my favorites in this book were Captain Jackson and Bess's father, whom she refers to as the Colonel Sahib, which is just wonderful. But can you tell us a little bit about them?
Well, we have found that secondary characters have to be as real as the primary ones, because if you aren't careful, the story can lose its vitality. These people become puppets or cardboard cutouts. Captain Jackson is a case in point. He came to France with the Lafayette Escadrille long before America entered the war. And he was with other pilots who wanted to do their bit, but mostly they wanted to fly. And now that the war is over, he's lingering in France because there's not much chance for flying at home in New Mexico. Bess is suspicious of his offers to help her because she's never seen him before. But, you know, she might just be right about him. The problem is, never in a million years would she guess why her suspicions are aroused.
During his service in India, Bess's father was called Colonel Sahib by his own men, the local people and the house servants. It was a term of respect, and Bess and his mother had picked up the nickname and used it as a fun but loving family joke. But it defines him, his career, and his character.
So is there anything I haven't asked you that you would like to talk about?
No, I think everyone loves Bess for a very good reason. She's a strong person, and yet she's vulnerable at times. She has a strong sense of duty, and it's that and her tenacity and her training that give her the courage to finish what she starts. She doesn't turn to the nearest strong man and say, help. She has to figure it out for herself because there's no one else to do it for her. They may give some assistance, but in the end, it's up to what she has seen and what she knows about a situation.
And she never had the confining Victorian upbringing of girls of her age. So she's a hint of a modern woman to come. She drives. She knows how to handle guns and things like that. She didn't need to go to war, but she felt it was her duty. And as she faces her future, not knowing what lies ahead of her, she has choices to make. But once again, Bess is not one for the quiet life. And coming soon, a wedding in Ireland involves her in the troubles there.
I look forward to that one. So do you still need to research your novels, or after 30, do you have World War down to a fine...
Science.
Science, yes.
Well, there's always research to be done. You can't rest on your laurels, so to speak. Every setting is different. Aspects of the war will come in different ways. Society is changing. These are always, you know, a challenge. We go to England every year to walk the streets and whatever village we're thinking about using. We look for a story that works with that individual village or part of the country, and we want to take the story in new directions, not just the same old, same old. So we're looking for something that will bring the war and the life in England or what's happening in France into the story in a very natural way. It's a challenge, but it's also a great deal of fun to use all of this material in different ways in each book and still keep the freshness of what's happening.
I want you to know, I it was a great personal sacrifice working on this book that I had to go spend a week in Paris in May. It was rough duty, but, you know, I persevered.
That was a noble sacrifice.
Yes, it was.
Absolutely.
We love research. There are always new nuggets that we find in the oddest places. And some of our readers actually send us fascinating information about their relatives who served in World War One and other interesting things that they come across. The fact that we've already learned so much about the period is really only the beginning to get it right, which is what is so important to us. We have to check every detail. For example, we wanted to name the pilot Captain Chapman. Then we read the list of the real escadrille pilots. And there was a man from Connecticut by the name of Chapman. So we had to give our captain a different name.
You never know what will crop up.
So you normally at this point, I ask my guests what they'd like readers to take away from the novel. And it's an open-ended question. It mostly gets at issues of theme or meaning. But it can also be, you know, I just want them to have a good time. Does it apply, do you think, to a mystery novel like A Cruel Deception?
There's always a theme of some sort in the Rutledge books. I mean, we talk about an idea before we get into the writing. But in this book particularly, a lot of people think that the armistice on November 11th, 1918, ended the war. It only ended the fighting. And so in order to finish this arc of Bess as a battlefield nurse, it was important to remind people that a peace treaty hadn't been written and that it took them quite a long time to agree on all the terms of that. But also the undercurrent in all of this is that the war will go on reaching out and touching lives even years later, and that those who actually survived it won't be able to put it behind them. And we've seen this in so many people whose families have had served in the war. In one way or another, there is a very strong tendency to look back and to try to understand.
And you see that clearly in the Rutledge books, which are 2 years ahead of the Bess series. A Cruel Deception is a story of delayed revenge. But it's also about the tricks the mind plays in times of great horror or stress and how that can twist the truth, how one man's mistake can trigger another man's guilt. For us, it was a real challenge to tell this story.
Are you already working on a new novel?
Well, we have the latest Rutledge coming out in February.
Right.
And we're already at work on the next Rutledge and the next Bess.
Well, Bess and Rutledge are such different characters with such different stories that as we finish one series, our thoughts are already moving towards the other series. And to make life more interesting, in between we write a lot of mystery short stories for anthologies and magazines. I think we egg each other on or commit each other to stuff. Why didn't you commit to that?
Well, thank you so much for sparing time to talk with me. It's been a great pleasure.
It's been our pleasure,
you.
Too.
And thank you for listening to our podcast. Once again, I am C.P. Leslie, the host of New Books in Historical Fiction, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. And today I've been talking with Charles Todd about A Cruel Deception and other novels. Find out more about them at www.charlestodd.com. If you enjoyed today's podcast and would like to discuss it further with me and other New Books Network listeners, please join us on Shuffle. Shuffle is an ad-free, invite-only network focused on the creative community. As NBN listeners, you can get special access to conversations with a dynamic community of writers and literary enthusiasts. Sign up by going to www.shuffle.do/nbn/join. Like us on Facebook, search for NB Historical Fiction, and follow us on Twitter at NewBooksHistFic. If you do, you'll see each time we post a new interview. You can find out more about me and my books at www.cplesley.com, where I upload expanded posts about the interviews and in general discuss history, historical fiction, and the rapidly changing publishing industry. Goodbye until my next conversation about historical fiction on the New Books Network.